From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines, and then a tribute to the late Glenn Kimball. But here's what's happening. In Arkansas, floodwaters rose as swiftly as 8 feet an hour, tearing through a campground packed with vacationing families early Friday, carrying away tents and overturning RVs as campers slept. Could you imagine that? At least 16 people have been killed, dozens more missing and feared dead, and dozens hospitalized. Heavy rains caused the normally quiet Caddo and Little Missouri rivers to climb out of their banks during the night. Around dawn, floodwaters barreled into the Albert Pike Recreation Area, a 54-unit campground in a national forest that was packed with vacation and families. The raging torrent poured through the remote valley with such force that it peeled asphalt off the roads and bark off trees. Cabins dotting the riverbanks were severely damaged. A 16-year-old sailor on a round-the-world journey alone was drifting in the frigid, rough southern Indian Ocean as rescue boats headed toward her yacht, damaged by 30-foot waves that knocked out her communications and prompted her to set off a distress signal. After a tense 20 hours of silence, a search plane launched from Australia's west coast made radio contact with Abby Sunderland on Friday morning. Her boat's mast was broken, ruining satellite phone reception, and was dragging with the sail in the ocean. The keel is intact, the yacht was not taking on water, and Sunderland was equipped for the conditions. The astonishing news that the oil leak at the bottom of the sea may be twice as big as previously thought could have major repercussions for both the environment and BP's financial health, killing more marine life and dramatically increasing the amount of company money that they must pay in fines and damages. Scientists now say the blown-out well could have been spewing as much as 2 million gallons of crude a day before a cut-and-cap maneuver started capturing some of the flow. David Bloom is one of those who's been monitoring this situation all along. David, here we go into another week, and they still haven't been able to stop this yet.
Well, they're not going to be able to, most likely, for quite some time, and they're still drastically underestimating the amount of oil that's coming out of this wellhead. As most of us who watch the gusher cam when they cut the pipe watched it go from a pretty awful-looking spew to Mount St. Helens all in one step. And they have the audacity to tell us it went up less than 20% when we're all watching it, you know. But that's not the big problem. You and I talked last about how there was very likely another fissure in the ocean floor.
Yes.
That oil was pouring through from this accident. And that's been now confirmed by photographs and sonar from NOAA. And Matt Simmons, oil analyst, was on just the other night confirming just what we predicted, at least 120,000 more barrels per day from the ocean floor, and that it's 5 to 7 miles away from this particular leak. So, but now they can see that there are actually different currents from that slight difference, and we can see they're going in different directions.
David, what would make that leak?
Well, like we talked about in the past, George, you know, when that blast went off on the rig at the top of the riser pipe, it sent a shockwave, compressed oil and natural gas down into the well, and somewhere the metal casing that's 4 miles into the earth split, and the pressure from the oil in the casing is now escaping through fissures in the rock and coming up through the ocean floor. You got to realize that somewhere in the drilling process, they went through an impermeable layer, a layer that the oil couldn't get past, and by drilling through that with the well and then providing this escape through the side of the well wall, we now have an ocean floor that can keep sprouting multiple gushers, especially if we try to cap the top of this well.
All right, maybe it's time for ethanol, David. David's website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Thanks, David. A Texas health insurance company is suing Pfizer, saying that the drug maker deceptively marketed three of its top-selling drugs, illegally encouraging doctors to prescribe them for non-approved uses and then paying kickbacks to the doctors. Federal regulators are considering a snack attack on the nation's airlines that would restrict or even completely ban serving peanuts on commercial flights. Advocates say that the move would ease fears and potential harm to an estimated 1.8 million Americans who suffer from peanut allergies. Peanut farmers and food packagers, though, they say, hey, this is overreaching. It's unfair. A Japanese spacecraft that visited an asteroid in 2005 is returning to Earth this weekend and should put on a brief but spectacular light show for Australians late on Sunday. The Hayabusa probe was launched by the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency on May 9, 2003. It rendezvoused with an asteroid on September 12th of 2005. We don't know yet if it picked up any material until they open up those doors. But our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, with us. Richard, regardless, this is a spectacular event.
Well, this is a spectacular save by the Japanese Space Agency. I mean, they have done an incredible thing here. This spacecraft was launched in May of 2003. Rendezvoused with Itokawa, which is a little asteroid a couple miles across, in September of 2005. And it looked initially as if they were successful, and then it looked like they were unsuccessful, and then the probe died, and they brought it back, and then they had to chart a very long, torturous course to come back to Earth the long way, you know, hundreds of millions of miles. And on Sunday morning, at about 10 o'clock our time, Eastern time, here in the United States, this thing's going to streak through the Australian skies at almost 8 miles per second and land a football-sized package, which hopefully will contain some fragments of this asteroid, which will then be rushed by air to the Japanese Space Agency, and we'll know maybe what this thing is composed of.
What if there's signs of life on this asteroid?
Well, it could be anything. I mean, yeah. I've been looking at this asteroid rather carefully because, you know, we've been getting ready for this return. And I got to tell you that I see evidence that there's not natural stuff on the surface.
Really?
Yes, really.
What might it be?
Well, it could be something, an ancient base. It could be an ancient ship that's just bashed and battered by millions of years of exposure. I mean, you know, remember, Phobos now is in the running. Steins, we did an analysis a couple of years ago from the ESA flyby there, and it's definitely not natural in terms of our analysis. So if we're looking at more and more of these tiny little outposts that were dotted around the solar system and were, you know, vanquished in some humongous catastrophic event, speaking of catastrophes that we're watching live on television right now, this little probe could be the harbinger of some pretty amazing things to come in the Japanese Space Agency.
Well, let's hope it's not Al Capone's vault, huh?
I don't think so. Incidentally, before we leave the subject of catastrophes, do you understand why no one in the major media is talking about bioremediation of this Gulf problem?
I have no idea why they are ignoring this.
I sent you some information last night on Carl Oppenheimer.
And that's a person you brought up when you were on with me last.
Absolutely. Right? This is a genius-level scientist. He spent 40 years. He was head of Scripps at one point. He's been on presidential commissions. He unfortunately died in 2007. But he had actual extraordinary results with bioremediation, which is nothing more than a cultured spectrum of microbes, ancient microbes, natural. There's nothing gene spliced here. There's no chemicals, nothing like that. There's no chemicals, no genetic modification. What he did was he found archaeobacteria. These are the earliest, most ancient forms of life on Earth. And he put together, after 40 years, what he called Oppenheimer's formula, which is now used all up and down the East Coast. I found from Massachusetts to Florida. The state of Texas has authorized this for oil spills. It is expandable. You produce this stuff in packets. You take C-130s. You drift it over the ocean with oxygen in the packets so that you don't deplete the oxygen in the water. In 6 weeks, this stuff cleaned up oil marshes in Texas that have been fouled by huge amounts, millions of gallons of oil, and returned them to pristine conditions. And I haven't heard one official, Bobby Nungesser, you know, Senator Nelson, James Carville, who's becoming my new best friend because I love, you know, him ranting about the fact that nothing seems to be done. Why isn't someone talking about bioremediation and Carl Oppenheimer. This is a crime because it's the only technology, George, which can solve this problem, even as this thing continues to gush under the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, well, look, we want your take on this satellite when it comes back with this little asteroid piece, let's hope, and then give us some more information on these microbes as well. Thanks, Richard. Richard Hoagland, enterprisemission.com. Your voice is your identity, and it is far more than just a way to communicate your thoughts and feelings. It is, I believe, the expression of who you are. Up next, The Alchemy of Voice with Stuart Pearce on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Stuart Pearce was the master of voice at Shakespeare's Globe for 10 years. Stuart has also coached just household names such as Vanessa Redgrave, Diana, Princess of Wales, just to name a few. Stuart currently works in the corporate marketing, teaching presentation skills such as communication through the magnetic voice. And Stuart is the author of The Alchemy of Voice, and here he is on Coast to Coast AM. Stuart, welcome. Fascinating.
Well, hello there. What a pleasure it is to be on your show, George.
How did you begin to, I guess, listen for voices?
Well, as a child, as a very young child, I was educationally challenged, which meant that I couldn't do what most people wanted me to do. I believe that the reason for why this was so is because I was very preoccupied with the preternatural aspect of our existence. So, for example, in terms of sound, I saw sound. I literally saw sound as force, as color, moving around us. And, of course, a lot of that sound, because I was a small child, was very endearing and compassionate and easy. But some of it was not. Some of it was based in anger and control. So it's very difficult dealing with a lot of this. However, what it did was to give me this very rare appreciation that sound is one of the most extraordinary energies that we have around us and within us. And that unfortunately today, most of us are surrounded by noise, whether it be the monkey chatter in our heads or indeed the noise of the machine. So we deny the power of the fact that sound is at the core of creation.
Stuart, I used to get a kick out of my kids when they were young, when they were really starting to realize that they had voices.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would talk, but you could tell they were listening to themselves, and it was really cute. And, you know, as they got older, they began to work on their voice patterns and everything else. But it seems at a young age, children become aware of their speech patterns and who they are through their voice, don't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, particularly around 7, 8, 9, we become very much aware of, it's the area when the heart chakra really begins to open. So we become aware of our own self-knowing. You know, we reach a point of reasonable objectivity at that stage. I mean, obviously we need to see it within the context of a 7, 8, 9-year-old, where suddenly our voices matter. But I think it's much later. I believe it's much later. It's more to do with the 11, 12, 13-year-old period where we really tune into the way that we sound. And that's often when we change our voices to accommodate ourselves within the environment in which we're placed.
Sometimes a voice matches the person, other times it does not. Why is the voice so special?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I suppose the basic answer is that the voice always matches the person. But of course, what we're saying, what you're inferring is the fact that so often we hear a voice which somehow doesn't go with the physicality,
right,
or with the psychology, with the demeanor of that individual. Our voices are really at the very core of our being, so we formulate so much of our identity through them. Did you know, for example, that we each have our own note?
I didn't know that.
So each human being has their own note. The ancients referred to this as being persona, which, of course, is the root of the word personality, which we use to describe the quality of somebody's essence. The word persona in Latin means per through, sona, sound. So actually, when we're talking about somebody's personality or their essence, we're really talking about their sound.
When I was doing a local show in St. Louis, Missouri, years ago, I did an entire program on people calling in, and I had to guess what they looked like just based on their voice. And let me tell you, I was way off.
Well, it can be very difficult. I mean, for example, about a year ago, I was on a famous radio station here, and callers were calling in, and a voice came in like this. Hello, I just thought I'd ask if you can recommend can I do something with my voice? Now, it was a voice that was, as you hear, very timorous, very breathy, and very, very, very light. And then suddenly, it plummeted right down here like this. Now, the question that I was asked is, how old is the speaker? You know, the speaker said, how old am I? The caller said this. And it was difficult to tell where this person was coming from. You know, they were very rational. It wasn't that they were irrational. But, you know, it ended up that this man, it was a young man of 28, who had been surrounded by grandparents and great-grandparents when he was growing up. And he loved his grandpa so much that he'd actually emulated the whole vocal pattern of his grandpa. So this 28-year-old man sounded like a 78-year-old man.
That's something. Does the voice dictate whether the person becomes successful in the corporate world or their job or anything like that?
Well, I believe that the voice contributes to it, yes, but we're living in vastly changing times from that you and I were born into, George, where accent mattered. Today, accent doesn't matter as much as it did 50, 40, maybe even 30 years ago. But certainly, most of the CEOs, most of the high-level business executives that I work with, that although they may not be aware of their voices in the way that, for example, you are aware of your voice, being the radio show host that you are, or that I may be as a voice coach, that they have found a way of being able to, rather like a chameleon, shape their voices to be distinct for the environment in which they're placed.
When I was younger and just starting into this business, I always tried to change my voice. You know, I tried to deepen it. And all of a sudden, I got to a point where I said, you know what, this is not going to work. I am who I am, and this is it, and that's what I do now.
Yes, yes. So it's interesting, isn't it, that we have perceptions about our voices, our voice, that often other people don't have. And it's to do with this extraordinary chemical cocktail of the way that we perceive ourselves. We can also refer to other parts of our anatomy in similar ways, can't we? You know, that we feel that we're too fat. People say we're not. We feel that, one arm is longer than the other. People say it isn't. So, all these possibilities, these myriad possibilities of the way that we define ourselves. So I do believe that our voices are the mirrors of our soul, and so we feel very circumspect about offering them to the world when we're in situations that are very demanding, because we often feel very disempowered by something that's taken place which affects our physiology and then affects the way that we make sound.
Does that
make sense?
It does. And why do our voices sound different when we hear ourselves on audio tape, for example, or, digital?
Yes, it's interesting, that one, isn't it? That most of us, even those voices that we revere, those voices that are renowned, that there is a preoccupation by the speaker that they don't sound the same. I believe that the answer is very simple, that when we speak, we feel our voices both within and without. We hear them both within and without. But when we hear ourselves on an audio recording, we simply hear our voice on the outside. So there's no internal conduction.
Right.
And therefore, we're displaced by it. We're disoriented by it because we're only actually hearing an external formation as opposed to being uniquely, quintessentially involved in the internal production of sound. So you see, again, it goes into this preoccupation that I have with the magic of what our voices are all about internally, because they literally do mirror our soul, the essence of our being.
Who have been some of the great voices that you've heard in your career?
That I've heard. Well, I remember being affected because I was born in the immediate post-war years, post-Second World War years.
Sure.
I remember being aware of the great voice of Winston Churchill.
Classic voice.
And then, of course, because of my interest in sound and the way that the sound of the word conveys intention, conveys meaning, I was fascinated by the voice of people like Gielgud and Olivier and some of the great silver screen stars like Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn.
And their voices seem to fit their personalities. I don't know why I feel that way, but they do.
Yeah.
And we're going to take this break in just a second, Stuart. We're going to continue talking. I want to get your take on some of the people of this age and what you think of their voices and what that means. And the next hour, we'll take phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'll be right back. Doing double duty on Coast to Coast this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, is Ian Punnett. What do you got this weekend?
Well, I'll just tell you about Saturday night for now. The sure. Couple of big sporting events. How'd the Stanley Cup work out for you?
I won. I picked the Blackhawks. I love Philadelphia, and they played tough all season. But I picked the Blackhawks. They had home ice advantage, and so I won.
I think that's smart. And then how about the NBA finals here? You're an L.A. guy?
I'm a Detroit Pistons kind of guy.
Well,
and don't forget, my mom was born in Boston.
Right.
I'm living in L.A. part-time.
Right. So you going Celtics or you going Lakers?
It depends if I'm on the East Coast or the West Coast.
So, you know, lots of great sporting events and wonderful outcomes, and then lots of injustice along the line where you watch it, something, and you go, this just looks fixed. Well, coming up tomorrow night, The Fix is In. We'll talk to an author who's been studying this who says, you might be surprised. It isn't always the officiating. Sometimes it's TV. Sometimes it's sponsor pressure. But there's a lot more fixed outcomes in sports than anybody realizes. And we'll talk about that tomorrow night. The Fix is In. He'll explain which games have likely been fixed and all of the different pressures that go into a final score coming up tomorrow night.
I'll bet on that.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, Ian.
Thanks, George.
Ian Punnett. And we'll be back in a moment. What does your voice say about you? The Alchemy of Voice with Stuart Pierce on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Stuart Pierce. Stuart, how would you judge, in terms of voice quality, JFK, for example, and that New England accent that he had?
Sorry, George, I'm not quite with you in terms of how would I judge. Firstly, I wouldn't judge it, actually. I would assess it, maybe.
Well, how would you assess it?
Excuse the semantics, but you get the permutation. Well, when we go back to that extraordinary sound that he had, which was a mixture of the Irish brogue that he heard from his father and the contemporary 1950s, American, the point was that you could actually hear that he was very much in connection with the vibration of feeling. So whenever he spoke, even if he were actually delivering something of consequential might within the capital, that you could hear that he was actually grounded in something which was real and purposeful and essential, as opposed to, you know, going into the really, really high plane like this,
uh-huh,
where you feel the person is just simply not in connection with what they're really feeling, but they're much more engaged in that energy of rhetoric or hectoring or anger, as opposed to really feeling, you know, exactly where they're placed in terms of what they wish to offer to fellow human beings.
You can use your voice to control, I think, the attitudes of people toward you. What you just did, that change of voice and sound, you went from being, in my opinion, very professional, very in control, to someone who could have been erratic just by your sound.
Well, yeah, absolutely. As I was saying earlier, you know, our voices are at the very core of our being, so therefore they crystallize the whole of our identity. So the question is that they're physical mechanisms that we use to communicate the way we think and the way we feel, so where they're coming from within the temple of our bodies, that's really the point. Now, the sound that we hear so much today, the sound that comes to me mostly, whether this be a statesperson or a TV presenter or radio presenter or a CEO, whomever comes, that often what happens is they come along and say, look, I've been told that my voice tends to really reverberate against people. It's like I'm talking to people rather than for people. Is there anything I can do about this? Now, I mean, what's interesting as I shift the energy once again is that the first voice is the sound that seems to be the voice of the intellect, the cerebral resonator, who spends most of his or her time walking across harsh, unremitting concrete, working in small containers and living in small containers. As soon as we move into a rural area, we hear a voice which is much more modulated, which is possibly lower or deeper or fuller within the body, and much more in connection with the breath. Now, I'm not suggesting that one voice is right and one voice is wrong. I'm just making observations about where energy comes within our bodies. So to go back to the original point that you were making, George, can we control a situation? Well, if we're control freaks, we can control anything. What I tend to suggest is if we substitute the word control for management, can we manage the way that people perceive us? I believe we can. But the majority of us are not really tuned into our bodies. We're not really tuned into the sounds that we make. And that's one of the reasons why we're so disenchanted in our lives and why our societies or cultures take on the major disenfranchisements or dispossessions that they do. It's not just because of economic status. It's to do with the way that we think and feel about economic status. Does that make sense?
It does. And how important, Stuart, is your body language with your voice, the movements, your hand gestures, and all that?
Yeah. Well, of course, there are many presentation consultants who say that when we're engaged in public speech, that we need to be really still with gesture. I tend not to affirm myself in that direction because it feels to me that when we gesture, that there are many fluid movements that we use that are really part of the whole substance of what it is to be a human being, and that if we actually close somebody off from using gesture, they feel very tight, they feel very reduced, they feel very minimized. However, having said that, of course, there are repetitive gestures which some of us can use when we're very tense. For example, a broken wing syndrome. You know, have somebody standing in front of you, whether it be a professional communicator, a teacher or whomever, an actor, and they're so tense that their left or right elbow is shooting out. We as a member of the audience, we become aware of the jerk that's taking place in the body. Now, I don't particularly see that gesture is a very useful one. It's much more to do with the inner coil of tension that the person is exploring rather than the fact that their energies are free flow and easy.
It gets to be annoying if you're in the audience sometimes, doesn't it?
Indeed, yeah.
How would you assess someone like Hitler, who had the ability to capture the masses with his voice, the way he sounded, his gestures? I mean, as diabolical as he was, he was a captivator of an audience. Was a lot of that because of his voice?
Well, it was an extraordinary frequency that he used, wasn't it? And, of course, the frequency that we're talking about in this moment, I believe, are some of those extraordinary rally speeches that we remember, the Sieg Heil, that we remember.
Yes.
Yes, that's what we're really talking to. Because I don't know what Adolf Hitler sounded like when he was sitting with Eva Braun having dinner. So we're talking about a particularly
public probably the same way
of energy, aren't we?
I wonder if he did the same thing at the dinner table.
I would doubt it. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And to be frank, I haven't actually spent much time, as it were, dwelling in the science of what we're looking at, you know, being in terms of analysis of going into it very specifically. But I would suggest that he was using a vibration that the German peoples at that time felt coherent with. Now, the interesting thing about the German peoples when we hear their sound is that, for example, I often work in southern Germany, in Munich, and I have dear friends there. And when they speak to me in English, they tend to sit very high in the voice. Du sprichst Deutsch, ja? So you see, automatically, the vibration is quite up here. So we're going into that sound of... I'll stop it. We go into that sound of rhetoric that we remember from Hitler. And I believe that he was using a sound. I believe that it was conscious. I believe his think tank gave him this information, that he was using a sound that entrained the hysteria of the German peoples because of the huge economic pressures that they were living under as he came to prominence and began his regime.
Hollywood, Stuart, has done, I think, a phenomenal job tying characters with their voices. I remember an old television program called Hogan's Hero, and Hogan had, there was a sergeant, a German sergeant, Sergeant Schultz was his name. And, you know, he was the perfect stereotype of a German soldier. You know, my name is Schultz. But Hollywood picks characters with their voices and the way they handle themselves. Is that something that directors and producers look for? They try to cast the voice with the part?
Well, yeah. I mean, today I would suggest that it's slightly different, because it seems that the majority of the leading creative operatives, like the directors you're talking about, aren't that aware of people's voices. I mean, aren't that aware. Of course, the voice is there, but are much more preoccupied with the visual look of the person. Whereas when we go back, say, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, more significantly, we remember that voices truly ratified somebody's social status.
How would you assess former President George Bush's voice?
I notice my hesitancy, because automatically there are so many images that bombard us think in that moment of the end of his presidency. It was a voice that, for me, never really shared the personality of the man fully with his listener, in the way that, for example, the great, infinitely, profoundly resonant President Obama sounds. When you hear President Obama speaking, you hear the whole of his being resonating, vibrating, reverberating through your consciousness. And it isn't just what he's saying, it's the way he's saying it. Now, a lot of people say to me, yeah, but he's been trained to speak like that. Well, whatever. The fact is that the man is physically and emotionally alive. So you feel that his heart is in everything that he has to offer, even if he has to say something which is relatively stern.
And even if he's reading with
Mr. Bush.
Yeah. See, even if President Obama reads from a teleprompter, he is one of the greatest speakers I've ever heard.
Yes.
You know, regardless of the politics.
Yes.
But I mean, in terms of just being able to converse,
yes,
he's good.
Yeah.
When you go out and listen for these great voices, what do you listen for first?
Well, it would be coy to say it, but obviously what I'm tuning into is the entire, you know, this word timbre of the voice, the very core of where the person is coming from. Because right in the very center, as I was saying earlier about the fact that we each have a note, a signature note, is that person in relation to that note. Now, we can all feel this within the sensorium of our bodies, because literally we pick up the way that subtle feeling states vibrate through us, through the vibration of the sound. For me, when I'm tuning into somebody and I hear that note, that something deep within me sighs, because I know that I'm actually speaking to somebody who has integrity. We can feel this. You know, the ancients, they literally measured their lives through integritas, through gravitas. So in other words, what they did was to work on their bodies. They worked on their voices. They worked on their inner beings to find a way of integrating each aspect of being physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, so that they became integrated and therefore had integrity. So that's what I'm looking for. If I'm hearing a voice that doesn't resonate through integrity, then I, as gracefully as possibly, ease my way away from that being, because I know that whatever I ask them, they're just going to use the word that is common parlance today, bullshit me.
The signature note, how do you find it?
Well, you need to drink a lot of whiskey. what do you need
or
to
vodka?
Is very simply, firstly, is to find out how one's breathing, because we can only make these sounds that we're making if we're in connection with our breath. And of course, we know breath is an amazing instrument in our lives. Indeed, it is life itself. We know this because when a child is born, as the child emerges from mama's body, the first thing it does is to breathe in and then make sound. So firstly, it's a question of really looking into the very origin of the way that somebody breathes. And most people are completely unaware of the way that they're breathing, even though it is the very vitality, the divine elixir of their lives. So if we're breathing very fully and reasonably deeply, and I don't mean that we're forcing the air into our belly, but if we're actually feeling that the rib cage and the abdomen or the diaphragm is open, you know, a lot of people talk about diaphragm. We can't actually feel the diaphragm moving, but what we can feel is the way that the movement of the diaphragm shifts the contents of our stomach because our abdominal wall comes out. So, for example, if somebody, you know, if the listeners were now sitting in an aligned position with their spines as aligned as possible, and they just let all the breath go right out of their body until they feel the need to breathe, and then to breathe in so that they feel the ribs opening and the breath opening deep within their abdomen, and then to produce a hum in their forehead, they'll feel a very high frequency pitch. If they were then to take in another breath and do the same thing, but on this occasion using the pitch as though it were a white light, taking it down through the length of the spine like an elevator going down a shaft to the heart, and maybe they need to breathe in again, and then just humming in the middle of their chest, in their heart center, they will feel a relaxed, comfortable tone or note that will indicate to them their signature. It's as simple as that, George.
But once they learn this technique and this ability, once they get it down, does it stay with you forever?
It depends on how awakened the individual is. It depends on how that person is formulated through habit that creates normal behavior as opposed to natural behavior. So we're inhibited by so many tensions, physically and emotionally, that we contort our bodies into certain behavioral patterns that are completely unconscious. It depends on how open an individual is. But let's say we're dealing with Mr. and Mrs. Average, i.e. somebody who sensates within their body, who cares about their body, who cleans their body and addresses their body by eating good food, mm-hmm. good waters, that they're alive. But it takes a matter of seconds for that person to feel a way of really tuning into the very core of their beings. You see, the crucial thing here is that if words arise from the heart, they will enter the heart. If words arise from the tongue alone, they will not pass beyond the ears.
And I guess on Valentine's Day,
yeah,
people know if it's from the heart.
Exactly. Well, I suppose the Valentine's Day is a beautiful, thank you for mentioning that, it's a beautiful opportunity for us to really all tune into the softness and the delicacy and the compassion of our hearts. I would like it to happen every single day of our life.
Absolutely, and there's no reason why it should not.
But isn't it wonderful that we still have a ritual like Valentine's where we specifically concentrate on the endearment of our loving?
When people sing, and, you know, we've heard great voices and we've heard not so great voices, some people are tone deaf.
You think your Americans got talent?
We need to do a TV show like that, right? Let's get signed.
Hey, now that's a great idea, George.
Yeah.
I'm waiting
I'm just a little
one
late.
Of the great American TV companies, or indeed the BBC, to do a really great show on the entire topography of the human voice. Can you imagine?
That might work.
Oh, George, I would love
you would be great as a judge.
Maybe we're stirring something in this moment.
You would be excellent.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
You'd be like Simon.
You'd be like Simon.
Simon, you'd as a judge, you'd be, you know.
Mr. Cow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I want the listeners to really hear is that I'm an empowerer using voice as a modality. So in other words, for 25 years, I've pioneered sound as a healing modality. So my take of human voices is that I'm interested in empowering people rather than judging or diminishing people, which I know a lot of my colleagues do.
Good for you.
So I'm really interested, you know, in looking into the whole fiber of are we noble in mind and using our voices thus? Are we always choosing the highest choice? Are we always moving towards some form of enlightenment? Or are we making a lowest choice and being base in our lives?
Stuart, we're going to take this break, and we're going to come right back with you, and we'll take some phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.